What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Damage Report. I'm looking at the wrong camera. There you are. How are you guys doing? Anna Kasparian and Brett Ehrlich with you. John Idarola is unfortunately out, but that's all right because we have a great show ahead for you guys.
This is my first time at the big table.
Yeah.
Or as I've come to call it, and I think this might be inappropriate, especially on a day like this, Tabia Majora. Tabia Majora.
What is, I don't know what that
it's
is.
It's like the major table, but it sounds like. Good morning, everyone.
Good
it's
morning.
Friday. What a crazy week.
It's been a crazy week. It's been a crazy morning, but I don't want that to influence your decision about whether or not to watch the rest of this show because we have great stories ahead for you. We're going to talk about what some Democratic candidates are saying about some of the restrictive anti-abortion legislation that we're seeing in some of the red states. Later on, we're gonna talk about the equal rights that some Democrats want to extend, actually all Democrats would like to extend to the LGBT community and what Republicans will do to stop it. There's been a little bit of drama between members of Donald Trump's administration, especially when it comes to the issue of foreign policy. We're gonna talk about all of that. So it's gonna be a great show, I'm looking forward to it. And with that said, you wanna get started?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. As we all know from this entire week of the news cycle, there are various red states that have passed incredibly restrictive anti-abortion legislation. First, you have Alabama, which signed into law a complete abortion ban, making absolutely no exceptions for victims of rape or incest. And then Missouri followed suit, banning abortion after 8 weeks. It's not as restrictive as Alabama's abortion law is, but the Senate in Missouri decided to pass that legislation. It's now going to the House where it's likely to pass, and the governor has already noted that he will sign it into law. Now, with that said, Elizabeth Warren, who of course is a senator from Massachusetts and is running for president, has put out notice to essentially warn these anti-abortion crusaders that Congress might take some legislation up on this issue if Roe v. Wade gets struck down in the Supreme Court. So first, she says, quote, "This is a dark moment. People are scared and angry, and they are right to be, but this isn't a moment to back down. It's time to fight back." And then she proposes what she would do. And it even goes further than even I'm comfortable with, and I'll explain why in just a minute. First, she calls on Congress to enshrine the right to abortion in federal statute in case Roe v. Wade is overturned and the current federal right to abortion is taken away. So far, so good. Mm-hmm. I'm in favor of that. She also calls for a repeal of the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal funding for most abortions and federal legislation preventing states from passing medically unnecessary restrictions on abortion clinics. The second part about the restrictions on abortion clinics, I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I agree with repealing the Hyde Amendment.
You've lost. That's what I think. Uh-huh. I think you've already lost. Because my taxes pay for roads I don't use.
Mm-hmm.
My taxes go into federal funding. And then all of this is an embarrassing, sad situation we've placed ourselves in. Because I hate to, what's more enshrined than a federal statute? The Constitution, right? And the Supreme Court has already found abortion to be constitutional.
Right.
So that's what that means, is that when the Supreme Court was done with it, they were like, the Constitution says you can have an abortion,
right,
according to our interpretation now. And that vote on Roe versus Wade wasn't 5-4, it was 7-2. It was 7-2. Let's move on. Let's get over it.
I agree with you on that.
And that decision was based on some kind of scientific approach they did. So this new barrage of perverse spaghetti throwing at the Supreme Court to see what mm-hmm. sticks makes me sick.
I totally agree with you on that. It's frustrating that we keep coming back to this issue over and over again. It should have been completely adjudicated in the 70s when Roe v. Wade was decided, but we keep coming back to it. But the issue of the Hyde Amendment, the reason why I hesitate with that isn't because, and you make a good point in that our taxpayer money funds all sorts of things that we don't use. But there's a twist when it comes to the Hyde Amendment, because it's essentially using taxpayer money to fund something that some people really do have a religious issue with, right? So if you have a, I don't think people have religious problems with roads, but they do have religious issues with funding abortions.
I have a religious problem with roads. I think that so I personally am a Greek mythologist by religion and transitively a Roman mythologist. And all roads lead to Rome. Thus, if a road does not lead to Rome, religiously, I'm against that road. So I don't want any of my money going to that, period. Scientifically, as I said, I hate to get into it, but like I feel like I'm already lost an argument when I start saying that scientifically they say that like embryo's been, you know, has all the stuff it needs to eventually become a human. Well, so do separate eggs and sperm. What is it? The movement, the sperm can move.
Right.
In the Roe v. Wade decision is the logic that there's not an independent life form in there. It's at that point we just can't make a woman do something. And I think maybe as you see all these different like laws being proposed by and passed by Missouri, all those other ones that are like all the way crazy over here, maybe we as liberals aren't doing that enough. So I think that we should pass a law that says that everyone needs to get an abortion. In California, my new law says that every human being, male or female, must get an abortion. All right, Washington State. Washington pass a law saying that all women need to get abortions. Not, we have exceptions for men.
Right, right.
Men do not need to get an abortion. We think that's too draconian. But women all need to get an abortion. And then every little increment on that crazy side of the scale, because essentially that's what's happening.
That is what's happening.
On the right.
The way that you just illustrated that was pretty genius, right?
Because I am smart.
You're talking about two different extremes, and unfortunately, we keep getting dragged into the right-wing extreme of things.
Which is like a crazy use of pseudoscience that's, like they need, I think they need to dress in the style of the era from which their science derives in order to communicate to us fully. Because you see people in like snazzy suits and fancy pins. No. Go back and wear full pilgrim garb if you're going to pitch it.
So what do you think is really behind this push for anti-abortion legislation? I would argue that there's a small percentage of people who genuinely do think it's life from the moment of conception. But I would argue that the larger population of the right wing that keeps pushing for this type of ban on abortion, there are other factors at play, either political, you know, gain that they think they'll get through, you know, pushing for this type of stuff, or because let's keep it real, there's an element of control. There's an element of controlling not only what women can do with their bodies, but more importantly, what women can do with their futures. Because reproductive control has a lot to do with economic freedom, right? It has a lot to do with deciding where your entire life heads. You have a child, doesn't mean it's gonna ruin your life, but it certainly will ruin, you know, the outcome of your career in a lot of ways, or the outcome of your financial independence. And it doesn't mean it's going to completely destroy it, but it's going to be a lot more difficult to get to where you need to be.
I think there's three parts of it. Okay, the first is, I think they think they're saving babies. And I would just go back and say, well, science, I think a lot of that comes from religion, which we've all agreed, well, not us, the founding fathers have all agreed should stay out. Right? So that we need to dismiss, and we can talk about the science of like, yes, it has all the DNA necessary to eventually become a baby, but we have already done the science. That's Roe versus Wade, is the science argument. But a lot of them think they're saving babies, and that I can't overstate how important that is to them as someone who went to a Catholic school. They really do think that. And I get it. I mean, I guess I do respect them trying to save innocence. Second is the people. Why is there a push now? Because they have the Supreme Court that they want, that they've been working since Roe to get. And that's why there's a push right now. Third, it is the, you look at all the men who are passing these laws, they just want to stay in power.
Right.
And the same thing that keeps money in politics keeps this as an issue. They physically, individually, their personal motivation is to stay in office.
I think it's a good way of putting it. The political drive behind it is infuriating because, again, people's lives are really on the line here. Their livelihood is on the line here. And it just seems as though these very states that keep pushing this type of these types of laws are the same states that have absolutely no interest in protecting programs that help needy kids. So just something to think about as we go to break. But when we come back, one of my favorite stories of the day, Mike Pompeo and John Bolton are in a bit of a tiff, and I love the drums. So come right back.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Welcome back to the Damage Report. I'm Anna Kasparian and Brett Ehrlich joins me. By the way, Brett Ehrlich is the senior producer for the main show, something that you guys should be watching.
Yes, also watch Happy Half Hour. I apologize, Brooke Thomas is on the show this week. I know you don't like her on the show very much. We put up with her.
What did
getting
you guys,
so many head shakes from the control room.
What did you guys drink this week?
We drank champagne with Saint Germain. What's my name?
That is so good. Like, I love that. That's very Brooke-esque, like classy. Like,
it is great.
Yes.
The story is, as you'll find out on the show, which is available in video form for members of TYT Now Good Morning, is I had a whole plan last time she was on the show, which was exactly a year ago. And the drinks were fine. Some of them were gross. And she was like, and I got her Saint Germain because that's what she likes. And then she's like, just put this with champagne. And it was so good.
I want to try that. I've never tried that combo.
Let's do it. We ran out of champagne because people stayed after.
Love it. All right. Well, we go from fun to even more fun because it has to do with drama within the Trump administration. As we know, there has been chaos within the Trump administration, and this time around, it's between the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and Donald Trump's National Security Advisor, John Bolton. Now, John Bolton, the mustachioed man who has never met a Middle Eastern country he didn't want to bomb, is pushing for war with Iran. And tensions have been escalating between the United States and Iran, especially this week. And recently, there was an article published by the Washington Post that appeared to show that Donald Trump does not want to invade Iran. He is kind of frustrated with the fact that Bolton has been pushing for this war and things have been escalating. And now it turns out that Pompeo is more of a Trump lackey than Bolton is. And as a result, Bolton is listening to what Trump wants. I'm sorry, Bolton is listening to what he wants, and Pompeo is listening to what Trump wants. So there's a little bit of friction. So according to Politico, Pompeo and his special representative for Iran, Brian Hook, have indicated that the administration's goal in squeezing Iran is renewed negotiations with the Iranian regime, something Trump expressed a desire to do. So the argument here is, look, we need to approach this from a more diplomatic perspective. Sure, let's implement these sanctions against Iran. That's gonna hurt them economically, and hopefully that'll bring them to the table so they negotiate. Now, Bolton, though, is a deep skeptic of the value of negotiating with adversaries who, before joining the White House, called publicly for regime change in Tehran. And remember, Bolton is also one of the Bush administration officials who pushed for war with Iraq. So he didn't learn his lesson then, certainly isn't learning his lesson now, and he certainly does want to invade Iran.
Does a man with that mustache look like he learns lessons?
No.
Or takes feedback?
He looks like a walrus.
He does. Cuckoo could chew. Cuckoo. He's cuckoo.
He is cuckoo, yes.
So John Bolton and Donald Trump, to me, for those of you who've watched Game of Thrones, feel like Cersei and the Faith Militant, where he's like, oh, I need a cudgel with which I can win some kind of political battle. And so he goes to the person renowned for being the most purely something, and that something is militant. And it's like he's shocked to find out that that's what Bolton's really like.
That's such a good point. Because what I couldn't really understand was why Trump would want Bolton in his administration in the first place. First, if you can recall, in the beginning of his administration, H.R. McMaster had filled this role, but H.R. McMaster's now gone, and now Bolton's in his place. The reason why Bolton wasn't Trump's first pick was because Trump didn't like Bolton's mustache.
Literally.
That was a thing.
That's how he works.
Yeah.
H.R. McMaster, our Trump, it's crazy to see that Trump like developed as a person. He could really understand someone besides what's on the surface. Mm-hmm. In a rom-com, that would be just like a great breakthrough moment. But here it means international conflict and potential nuclear war.
Exactly. And so now, look, this is my speculation, but based on recent reporting, it looks like Trump might have regretted choosing Bolton for this role because they do differ when it comes to Iran. Trump's campaign included this idea of putting America first, of course, and part of that is not intervening or engaging in war, and he is not in favor of these regime change wars. Now look, Trump isn't someone who really seems to have a strategy for anything, but he does seem to care about keeping his campaign promises.
This now makes sense. The only thing that doesn't make sense, the first graphic you read about squeezing negotiations back into effect makes sense with Trump because he wants to beat Obama. Obama did a negotiation and that's it. And he needs the threat of war essentially in effect in order to have like that final thing where it's like, if the economic thing doesn't work, then war will happen. But Trump, I think his goal is to like just get a slightly better deal than Obama. But Bolton's goal is 100% war.
Yes.
That defeats and creates regime change in Iran. You don't have to take my word for it. Take his speech that he gave right before he got the job where he said, I want a regime change in Iran. He is that old guard. Before America learned, before the people in charge realized that the human beings in America learned from that and know better now than to just say, I guess the people in those positions have our best interests in mind and we'll advocate for them.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a little more of what Bolton's been doing, and this seems to be frustrating Trump and Pompeo as well. So on Bolton's watch, twice weekly 7:30 a.m. phone calls McMaster hosted to coordinate plans amongst senior national security officials stopped the day he arrived at the White House. So he kind of likes pursuing foreign policy issues unilaterally or as much as he possibly can unilaterally. Of course, you're gonna have to brief the president on what you wanna do or what you intend to do. But Trump hadn't been briefed on Bolton's plans and Trump was getting frustrated about that. And it seems like he has no interest in really communicating with other national security advisors either. Also, Bolton is not very collaborative. This is according to an individual who's close with Pompeo. He likes to do stuff himself. Pompeo is more collaborative by nature. And even if he weren't inclined to be collaborative, he feels that he should be collaborated with because he's Secretary of State. And agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there should be an open line of communication among administration officials. But really, the broader look at this story and the administration overall is that from the very beginning, there has been complete and utter chaos.
Yeah. So there's the terms, keep it simple, stupid. Mm-hmm. I would say for Trump, you have to adapt it to stupid keeps it simple. Because he's stupid and yeah. It's not that complicated. I think with Bolton, he actually does want this war. And it makes me think more about Obama. Like Obama, it seemed like his goal was not crazy runaway nuclear proliferation, used sanctions to get Iran to the table and accomplished the goal of nuclear non-proliferation and got that. Yeah. And that was his goal, was let's just get a deal that everyone can come together on, the world agrees, and now nuclear proliferation isn't happening in Iran. But that's not what the Bolton Trump camp is. Trump's goal is not peace and what's good for the world, it's to best Obama somehow.
Yes.
And then Bolton's goal is, listen, we can't ever have a strong Iran, ever, because they are not motivated by what's good for them or even like regional stability or regional power. They're an evil empire. They're a theocratic evil empire. They will mm-hmm. always be evil Muslims. So we need to obliterate that. And if you go back into the history of Iran, the reason they did what they did is because we messed with them and put in a leader
yes.
that then was rebelled against and all that. So we meddle a lot. We get this kind of stuff. Just look at the history of Iran. It's absolutely fascinating in what it's done and how much of what they've come up with in the universe we use as like a fundamental system of understanding things. It's just a fascinating history.
It really is. And finally, I just wanted to make a point about Trump's tactics, because I think you were so right in that he wants to one-up Obama. He wants a better deal, even though the Iran nuclear deal did exactly what it was supposed to do. Iran had basically shipped out 95% of its enriched uranium. So even if they decided to stop complying with the nuclear deal, which to this point they have been complying, even though the US pulled out, it would take them years to develop a nuclear weapon, meaning they are not an imminent threat to the United States. They keep the Trump administration, Bolton specifically, keeps trying to make it seem like they're an imminent threat to the United States. They are not, so don't fall for that propaganda. But you're right in that Trump wants to one-up Obama. And I think that he is using this threat of war, which certainly happened with North Korea, to bring Iran to the table for negotiations. But here's the thing, you might have brought North Korea to the table for negotiations, but that didn't end up so well, did it? Now, I'm glad that he did that, because at least that de-escalated tensions. But let's see if your strategy works with North Korea before you try it with Iran. Anyway, we gotta take a break. When we come back, we have more news for you, including what farmers are dealing with when it comes to this trade war with China and how Trump is trying to calm them down. Welcome back to the Damage Report. John Ederola will be back next week, but for now, I will be hosting along with Brett Ehrlich.
Sorry.
This show is so well done. Can I just say, what was that?
I flex. Uh-huh. And it's not as big as John Ederola.
Ederola.
And I apologized for not doing the push-ups and the flexing.
I thought you were doing that push-up
that
challenge.
That ended the day I stopped talking about it.
That's hilarious. I don't blame you. I was doing the squat challenge.
Yeah.
And squats are not that hard.
No. A billion of them are.
Yeah, that's true. But doing, you know, X number of squats, like 100 squats a day, that's not that tough. But it's just laziness, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, we're all busy, okay? We're all gathering the news for you. Not really. By gathering, we're reading articles that we think are interesting.
No, don't tell them the secret. Don't tell them the secret.
But we analyze them. That's the difference.
There it is.
Okay? We give you like the context and really like the inside details that most people don't know about. We're gonna do that right now when it comes to the trade war. Donald Trump is, of course, still engaged in a trade war with China, and the ramifications for farmers are already being felt. But all of us are gonna feel the consequences soon as we notice the prices of products that we need rising and becoming less and less attainable, especially for people who are working minimum wage jobs. But Donald Trump is asking farmers, many of whom voted for him, to do the patriotic thing and just suck it up. Now, he says, quote, "Our great patriot farmers will be one of the biggest beneficiaries of what is happening now." But here's the thing, a lot of them will never be beneficiaries of what's happening now, because many of them have lost incredibly important trade relationships. And once they lose those relationships, do you think that their previous trade partners are just gonna stop and wait until trade is better again? No, they're going to make new relationships with farmers in other countries, and that's certainly happening right now. So the long-term ramifications are real. Farmers are really suffering from it, and I actually would like to hear from farmers themselves rather than putting words in their mouths. So let's take a look.
Tell us, what has the impact been on our farmers?
It's been insane. We've had a lot of farmers, a lot more bankruptcies going on, a lot more farmer suicides. These things are highlighting many of the news stories in our local news. But we have more commodities, more grains sitting on the ground right now because we lost huge export markets. We lost export markets that we had for 30 years that we'll never see, never get a chance to get back again. So farmers are hoping and hopeful to get their crops in the ground this year, but really hopeful that we have a place to sell it come fall.
So I think it's important to hear those perspectives, because we're not talking about these massive, you know, corporate farmers. We're talking about small-time farmers who have had these farms passed down generation by generation, and they're really suffering right now, and there's no end in sight. And so what do you make of all of this? Do you think this is a smart strategy? Because there is a legitimate argument to be made about how China has been behaving over the last several decades, and they do need to be held to account. But at the same time, is this the best way to go about it?
All trade wars are wars of attrition to see who can blink, who's gonna blink first. Mm-hmm. And the strategy of Trump, the thing we were selling a lot of was food. Like, we were exporting grain and all that stuff. And the thing that they believe, and I believe that China is doing, is like massive intellectual property issues.
Yes.
I think that's more of a legislative thing where you punish them for their intellectual property violations. You find ways to enforce that through some kind of largely, like, I guess, legal process. Mm-hmm. Internationally. But if I were to summarize the Republican voting blocks, it would be people in the middle of the country who are socially in step with what they think. Like, traditionally, they're religious and they're like, I'm a wholesome social conservative. And then you have like the rich folks who are they just say like, China's killing us. That's all they say. And right now, the fact is that to appease the people who are saying China's killing us, there's a trade war. And the people it hurts the most are farmers. And it's up to the farmers to help. If they're hurting, of course they're gonna tell Trump that they're hurting. Those people are up for grabs. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, in all of this is the laborers in the Rust Belt. So he's gonna lose some of these farmers, and he's trying to pick up people in the Rust Belt by saying, I am going to protect your job. And what's crazy to me is the protectionist is the Republican right now.
Right.
So these are things that I don't think are huge losers for Trump. It is horrible PR for him to hear that farmers are committing suicide, but I don't think it's a huge loser for him, you know, in the long run.
You make a great point. Just to solidify your point even further, there is reporting out that indicates that this whole trade war is part of Trump's 2020 strategy to present himself as this protectionist, as someone who's willing to stand up to China. But you also brought up a really great point about intellectual property, and that is something that China has been guilty of. But couldn't one make the argument that part of the issue around intellectual property theft in China is because we keep shipping all of our jobs to China, and in order for them to make the products that their workers are making for US companies, you need to give them the information to make those products. Isn't that part of the intellectual property theft?
Well, yes, because they are like, so we have, in order to get your people to make this stuff, just send us the plans and we'll put them together, it'll be fine. But still, the protectionism or the tariffs, as opposed, like the whole thing that Obama kind of lost on, and the Bernie you heard say, like, get rid of the TPP. The strategy there was to raise labor wages abroad so that they would be on par with American wages. And American workers were like, I don't have time for that. Mm. And Trump shows up and is like, I'm going to make it more expensive to make stuff in China so that we have to make it in America. I don't see that as a loser for him.
I agree,
except
yeah.
for the people that China was buying stuff from us, which is food.
Yes.
And it hurts the farmers. And
yes.
are there more farmers than laborers? Where do the farmers live? In places where the other option is the godless baby murderers.
Fascinating. That's great analysis by Brett. Something to think about as we go to break. And when we come back, we have more for you, of course, including Kamala Harris and some of her camp getting a little salty over a question regarding Joe Biden. I'll tell you what it is and more when we return. People think that Game of Thrones is known for the Song of Fire and Ice, but I would argue that this presidential election, the 2020 presidential election, is full of fire and ice. And what you're about to see right now is fire and ice, all coming from Kamala Harris's campaign. Now, this story started off with an NBC reporter asking her this.
I think that, sure, if people want to speculate about running mates, I encourage that, because I think that Joe Biden would be a great running mate. As vice president, he's proven that he knows how to do the job. And there are certainly a lot of other candidates that would make for me a very viable and interesting vice president.
So that was a great answer from Kamala Harris after she was asked whether she would be a good running mate with Joe Biden. And I like the way she handled it, because to be quite honest, I would find that question, first of all, incredibly premature. Yeah. And secondly, insulting. Very, very insulting. Like, I'm running for president, so how about you ask me whether he would be a good running mate for me, homeboy? Right?
Yeah, because the reason you're asking me is not because of the polls.
Right.
It's because you can't imagine this being president of the United States.
Exactly.
Oh my God, so I watched... I try not to talk about my feelings about like Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon a lot, but I end up doing it. Chris Cuomo had this whole segment yesterday, because that's when I drive home from work, is when his show is like in the middle of it. And he's like, I don't know, I'm thinking about this for the first time. Next on the prompter. And he talked about like, we have 20 people who are running for president. Let's set up what they would be. Why don't they just agree on the whole cabinet right now? Which is a ridiculous thing. But when you go through how you allot that, he's just saying, all right, 70-year-old white dude, he who's the establishment, he's going to be president. And then who else is what? Let's go with our like token appointments from then on. It's very frustrating.
It is frustrating. And what annoys me the most about what's going on this early in the election cycle is how everyone is either propping someone up or just making all sorts of assumptions based on early polling, which, look, to be fair, early polling means something, but it doesn't mean much if you ask me, because there is a lifetime between now and the election and so many things can change. Just remember the last general election cycle and what happened. I mean, in the Republican side, there was this assumption that Jeb Bush was the front runner, period. And Donald Trump had absolutely no chance. Mm-hmm. And so to frame questions, especially when you have an opportunity to interview one of the candidates, to frame the question based on the candidate that you're just assuming is gonna win, I think is insulting to the candidate that you're actually having a conversation with.
Right now, polls are, have you seen this name before?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer is yes, more people vote for that.
Right.
And it's name recognition at this point. Something that absolutely happens. And this Something that absolutely happens is that on a debate stage, once you see people together, it tightens. That's just what happens. And that's why if you're in the lead in polls, you try to have fewer debates. And if you're behind in polls, you try to have more, just because the numbers bear that out, that every time you see two options, even if one is ice and fire and you're afraid of fire, the polling on that would just go like, 55, 45 on it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait for the debates to start, because that's when you really get a you get the opportunity to see whether a candidate is viable, right? So the poll numbers right now, in my opinion, don't indicate much about viability, but I think it does indicate a lot after you see the way they handle themselves in a debate. Can they fight back against, you know, framing that's meant to make them look bad on a particular issue?
Yeah.
And so I think it's premature for anyone to make up their minds. And I have a question about people who have made up their minds in just a minute, but let me finish this story about Kamala Harris. After that interview, apparently there were a chorus of Democrats sizing up her run and concluding she'd be perfect as Biden's running mate. And that has rapidly gone from a whisper campaign to a national narrative. And that would frustrate me. And so one person says, Christopher Cudlego from Politico says, last week members of the influential Congressional Black Caucus floated Biden and Harris as a dream ticket. Again, that would frustrate me. And there has been some response from people like her husband who have tweeted things like this: she's running for president, period. Ooh, I love that, Ice. I love it, I love it, I love it. So I love all of this. And finally, Senator Barbara Lee says Kamala Harris is seeking off the office of the presidency, period. She is qualified, more than capable to lead this country, and has never lost an election.
But she's a cop.
Yes.
Kamala's a cop. That's why she, and that's why you should say she's attorney general, because she's a cop. No, It is one of those things that gets floated because it's been focus grouped. It isn't like people are sitting around going like, I wonder, I just had this moment. No. It's how do we throw ideas at folks as they're forming their opinion to essentially, like Spider-Man, like tie it to a wall with the webs we shoot. You know, like that's what they do. As you're forming, it's just like, you're here. Kamala, got her, vice president. Get rid of her. They try to do that. And it's just so, this is the part of identity politics that people don't like.
Absolutely.
They're like, we should have a woman. We should have a black. Let's do a black. There's a black woman? Let's do it. Let's do it. And then we've got those votes. And that's the part of identity politics that is like a valid criticism, where it's someone feeling entitled to your vote because of who you, they, anyone is, and not because of what they believe, feel, or are experiencing personally.
While we were producing today's show, Brooke Thomas made a point that I thought was so good, and it's something that frustrates me as well. Yeah, so she said, you know, at this point already, it's ridiculous. You know, you have people who have already made up their minds, and they refuse to ever accept any critique of their favorite or chosen candidate, and they refuse to acknowledge the upsides of other candidates. And that certainly annoys me, because I haven't made up my mind yet. I know that I have a few candidates that I prefer over others, but again, I wanna wait until the debates happen, and I wanna be open-minded and accepting of some of the flaws for my favorite candidates.
Yeah.
But why do you think that is? I mean, I tweeted a story yesterday. I didn't even tweet commentary on the story. It was just, this is an interesting article that I'm reading on Mediaite. I'm gonna tweet it, and I made no changes to the headline or anything like that. And it was an article that seemed to be a little favorable toward Elizabeth Warren, and people lost it. Like, oh, that's so establishment of you. I'm like, hey, relax. I'm just sharing an article that I think is interesting, right? So look, to be fair, on this story, it was Bernie Sanders supporters who thought I was being too supportive of Elizabeth Warren by tweeting that article, and they started calling me the establishment, blah, blah, blah. How do we combat this? Because it's not really productive.
I would say with Bernie Sanders supporters, it is being skeptical of anything establishment is because of the experience last time, specifically when the establishment had a bunch of weird things and terrible things that they did that are proven to keep him down. And you don't, you know, fool me twice, shame on me. And so that's probably why. And that's just like the default setting.
Yeah,
I don't know if
I get that, by the way. I totally understand the reasoning behind that. But at the same time, I think that words lose meaning when you just toss them around and you apply them to people who aren't that.
I don't know. And I don't want to speak for anyone who said that, but I think for me personally, that fire that happens in me is just like a default on the internet setting where I'm like, stop now, shoot it down. All right, next one.
That's a good point.
And it might be that. But I hope that people, when they read those kinds of tweets, are like, I'm just going to click on the article and read it because more information is good.
Exactly. Totally. All right, guys. One more break. And when we come back, a little bit of good news coming from the House when it comes to equal protections for all. Welcome back to the Damage Report. Anna Kasparian and Brett Ehrlich here with you. I wanted to end the show on some good news, and this good news does come from the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives has just passed reforms to the Civil Rights Act, and that would include protections for the LGBT community. Many people don't know that although we have legalized same-sex marriage, we have not extended protections for the LGBT community. In fact, some states have rolled back or codified laws in order to prevent protections for the LGBT community. So it is important for the federal government to step in and say, hey, this is a civil rights issue and we want to make sure that members of the LGBT community are not being discriminated against when it comes to issues like housing, issues like getting a loan from a bank, those types of things. Now, the bill did pass 236 to 173, which is amazing. The bill, if it were to become law, would protect LGBT Americans from discrimination in applying for credit, housing, employment, and more. So great news. But here's the thing. Republicans are against it, and the Trump administration is unlikely to sign it into law. So Republican critics adamantly opposed the legislation. They say that it would harm religious freedoms, making it unlikely the GOP-led Senate will take up the bill. So I don't know if Democrats did this as part of a political strategy. I'm sure that was part of their reasoning. I'm sure the other part of their reasoning is because they genuinely care about this. And to be fair, there were 8 Republicans in the House who voted in favor of reforming the Civil Rights Act. But at the same time, this is unlikely to get anywhere in the Trump administration.
Ladies and gentlemen, you aren't allowed. So someone tweeted recently that why is it that a Christian can fire a gay person because they're gay, but a gay person can't fire a Christian person because they're Christian? And that proves that we need only one thing. Brothers and sisters, join me in forming the church of LGBTQ+. It is a religion because they say it's a choice for you to be gay. So it's a choice for you to stay in the Catholic Church or the Christian Church and have these discrimination against them. And so we are forming a religion. And in this religion, we say that we have to do things according to how we are. And it's our religious proclivities that force us to have these attractions that we choose, by the way. So if we incorporate being gay as a religion, this is a great workaround for the idiots who can't wrap their mind around how hypocritical they're being.
Yeah, that's a good point. But the idiots who are being hypocritical have no problem being hypocritical because these are oftentimes the same people who have no issues with honestly discriminating against Muslims based on their religion.
All the Catholic priests who molest boys, it seems like it's a religious thing to me. I'm just putting two things together and it's fine. And we accept them in the church of LGBTQ+. I just think that this is the only way to work around it because the other approach could be just people being reasonable and opening their eyes and letting things that make sense make sense. And that isn't happening. So we have to create a religion around it in order for it to be protected.
So what I would argue though is if Democrats in the House are doing this as a political strategy, if that is persuading them to take on this measure, and look, I'm glad that they took it on because I think it's important to have some discourse about this. They need to go all the way and they really need to hold Republicans in the Senate and the Trump administration to account for not supporting this, because there is all of this nonsense coming from Trump supporters who argue, no, he's actually very supportive of the LGBT community. He doesn't hate gay people. Yeah, he hates trans people. He's banned them from the military, but he doesn't hate gay people. Well, why wouldn't he sign something like this into law that would essentially provide protections for the gay community to ensure that they're not being discriminated against?
He's being real scaredy cat. He's acting kind of gay. He's acting like a sissy gay. I don't know. I'm trying to use their fears against them.
Oh, I see just, what you're saying.
I don't know what to do at this point. We were talking about it before, where it's like this is the point where people would look back and be like, these folks are being crazy.
Yeah. Well, look, Trump likes to use laws or proposals that Democrats don't sign into law as a political strategy against them. Democrats should do the same. Why isn't Trump signing this? Why isn't he pushing for this? It's because he does not care about the LGBT community. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.